Latter-day Peace Studies is produced by peace-loving members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Any views expressed herein are not to be taken as official positions of the Church or its authorities.
Latter-day Peace Studies presents Come Follow Me. I'm Christopher Hurtado.
And I'm Ben Peterson.
Thank you for joining us as we discuss this week's reading of Come Follow Me as outlined by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Our hope is that as we discuss the scriptures, we will come to a more perfect understanding through experiencing the atonement of Jesus Christ and find greater peace in our lives.
Welcome back to Latter-day Peace Studies presents Come Follow Me. I'm your co-host, Ben Peterson.
And I'm your co-host, Christopher Hurtado.
Today, we will be discussing 1 Corinthians chapters 8 through 13. I think I said last time that we would be talking about the rest of the chapters in 1 Corinthians, but that's not true. I guess this is divided up into 3 weeks. I think that's probably because there is the idea that 1 Corinthians chapters 14, 15, and 16 have a lot of content. I'm not sure if that's true, at least for us to discuss. We'll see when we get to it. Yeah. Sometimes when we look at stuff, this happens so often, right? I'm like, oh, there's maybe not a whole lot there. And then, you know, we talk for 2 hours about it. So.
That's right. Yeah. But there's certainly, it looks like there's a lot of stuff that's, I don't know, LDS doctrine-y stuff, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Plan of salvation type of narrative.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. That's why they kind of divided it out. Yeah. But that works for us. It's good for this discussion.
Yeah. In these chapters today, we are going to be discussing a lot of context that surrounds this concept of the food being sacrificed to idols or meat being sacrificed to idols. I think that this is some important context to provide for this. Before I had that understanding, at least within the Greco-Roman world of what's going on here and what the people were experiencing, a lot of these verses about this didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Paul in chapter 9 does something where he's defending his decision to work for a living as opposed to accepting financial support from others. And you know, some of the interesting things about this chapter are that there may not be a whole lot of doctrine for us to get at there in the chapter. And then there's other points in this reading where that similar kind of thing happens. When we get to chapter 11, there is some really strange stuff going on with how what Paul thinks about hairstyles, right? And it's strange to have so much commentary on hairstyles in scripture, but there it is. And we will talk about it when we get to it. He also has a lot of great things to say about what we call the sacrament or Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, right? And I think that we'll be able to recontextualize this a little bit and bring in some of the things that we talked about way back when we discussed the Book of Mormon into it as well.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. We call it the sacrament. There are sacraments, right? Yeah. For those of us who come from, you know, Riley and my Latter-day Contemplation co-host, former Catholic, I'm a former Lutheran. There are sacraments, and marriage is a sacrament. We say the sacrament. It's the only one, right? Even though we have marriage, for example. But yeah, Eucharist, Lord's Supper, yeah.
Yeah, we use the word ordinance in place of how, you know, they might say sacrament. And so if we want to try to bring it into our context, if someone were to say, oh, we take the ordinance, you would be like, well, what ordinance? And so that's right. How people are like, when we take the sacrament, they'll be like, what sacrament are you talking about? So yeah, that's just one little thing I do to kind of flip that terminology to help me recognize how other people, you know, view it when we say those things.
I think it's helpful.
Yeah. Chapter 12 talks about spiritual gifts. Paul makes a good case for perennialism, I think. And so some interesting things there. And then the crown of the whole thing, chapter 13, this is Paul composing poetry, right? This is just beautiful verse about love and spiritual gifts and explaining how really love is the preeminent gift of the Spirit, so to speak. It's what all the others really have to pull their meaning and power. They have to get all their power from love or else they are powerless in and of themselves.
The power of love. This has been my favorite chapter since I was a Lutheran boy.
All right, so let's jump in here to chapter 8, Christopher. You know, right off in verse 2, I love this statement. He says, Anyone who claims to know something does not yet have the necessary knowledge.
That's right. I was saying something like this earlier today on the phone with a friend, saying, you know, this stuff, and I was talking about Paul. It's not really clear. I remember you reading to me, Ben, a footnote. Paul's meaning here is not clear. And I thought, well, yeah. where is Paul's meaning clear? Why is this footnote only on one verse? And so I was saying, it's really not clear. What we really need here is so-and-so. He could tell us all about the meaning of this, of these chapters and what Paul is saying. And what I meant was, I was choosing someone who just doesn't know enough to know how little they know. Right. And so it reminds me of when Riley approached me about recording an episode of Latter-day Contemplation on justice. And I said, oh, no, 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 no. I know way too much about justice to know how little I know. I'm not about to go into that. That's a huge conversation, from antiquity to today. And I know all of what the philosophers have said about this. No, we ended up doing it. I think it came off okay. You can check it out on Latter-day Contemplation, but that's the idea here.
Yeah, it's like a lot of things. The more you zoom in on something, the more you realize, the higher and higher resolution it gets, right? The more it gets complex and so forth. And so, That just sort of echoed Socrates to me, Socrates saying something like, all I know is that I know nothing, kind of thing.
That's exactly what I meant.
Yeah.
The other thing about that verse, Ben, is he's saying knowledge puffs up. Is it the same verse? This is verse one, actually. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Yeah, it's verse one. So knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And so I think it's the perfect bookend to, you pointed out that we're going to end with 13, right? Where it's all about love. And so no matter what you have, whether it's knowledge, prophecy, all these things are going to fall away. And it's love that remains.
Yeah.
And so that'll be our bookend, right? This chapter 13 at the end, and this first verse in chapter 8 at the beginning.
Right. Now, there's a lot of discussion here in chapter 8 about meat or food being sacrificed to idols, and then what you do about that.
I've been wondering about this. I wasn't sure what to do.
So to provide a little bit of context here, what's going on in these Greek cities is you have these pagan temples. And there are different feast days, different festivals, right? And on these feast days, they would bring animals and sacrifice them at these temples. And then they would sort of have these community meals. They would eat the meals. And so there was basically like restaurants that were attached to these temples where they sacrificed the food. And then they would serve the meat that had been sacrificed. And this was a community event, right? This is your neighborhood 4th of July party, right? Where everybody comes and they grill everything and everybody has fun. Yeah. And you participate in this and everybody eats a brat and a burger, right? And that's the way you do it. Now, for a lot of the poorer people that didn't have much in it means, this would have been one of very few ways that they would have ever gotten and eaten meat in the first place. And so for Paul to come and say that they shouldn't eat the meat sacrificed to idols, right? That basically removes that from their diet, or at least, culturally, as they're becoming Christian or part of this community, they're leaving that practice and they're having to change this whole thing about their life. So, there's more to it, but that, I think, for me, having that understanding of this community event that's happening and these people now have to withdraw themselves from that, that's not just, a social issue, but it also becomes like an economic issue for how you provide for your household sometimes, right?
Yeah, and to make this even more interesting, I'm not even sure that Paul is saying that you can eat this meat. We'll come to that, right? We'll come to that conversation. And the other thing is right here in verses, 5 and 6, you get that Paul acknowledges, because you earlier you said pagan temples, right?
Yeah.
Well, what does that mean? Pagan means not our religion, somebody else's, right? Yeah. That's kind of what that means.
Yeah.
So it turns out that, Paul admits that there are many gods and many lords, yet for us, there is one God, the Father. I'm reading from the NRSV, from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom all things and through whom we exist. And this is a verse that I think, you know, again, it's this admission that there are other gods. And I think there's sort of a possible reading from an LDS standpoint where this is saying, yeah, there are many gods. There's a sense in which Latter-day Saints are polytheists, right? We call ourselves monotheists. We're polytheists. We probably should go back into the monolatry conversation, right? Mm. Monotheism, monolatry that we had in the Old Testament. But here, I don't think Paul's talking about there are many gods and the God of this earth is. That's not the conversation.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
What is this, Ben?
Yeah. So Paul is just acknowledging the, you know, state of religions and worships and ritualistic cults of the different deities, right, that people believe in. This isn't some sort of a theological point that we might make in context of like Joseph Smith's King Follett sermon or something.
It's more of a world religions conversation, right?
Yeah. Now, Paul distinguishes here and elsewhere in his letters, and this came up when we talked about in Romans, and he uses these terms weak and strong believers. And this is I think, an important concept to understand within the context of this meat being sacrificed to idols issue. So a weak believer to Paul, this isn't a condemnation or a judgment about the character of a person, okay?
Or the strength of their faith even,
exactly,
right?
Not even the strength of their faith. No, a weak believer is rather somebody who's coming from a different tradition that they were very heavily invested in. And so now they're coming to this new thing, right? This, for lack of a better term, Christian tradition, this community of Christ and this different God that they hadn't known before, right? And they're having to leave these old customs behind and they're having trouble with it.
Which, Ben, we know, by the way, can I say no one? Generally speaking, no one has been successful at doing, which is why we still have Christmas. And right. Halloween, right? We just took the pagan holidays and we sort of repurposed them and repackaged them and reappropriated them because we couldn't get rid of them.
Right. Yeah. So what Paul is saying here is a weak believer is somebody who, when they have left that old tradition, right, or that old religion, the polytheistic or pagan view, and have come into this community of followers of Christ, they have to leave it behind completely. Otherwise, if they go to those festivals and they go into those places and they sit down and they eat with everybody else, it becomes a religious experience for them, right? And it's something that detracts from their discipleship of Christ because now it's them turning back to their old ways. It would be like, in some ways, and forgive me if this is insensitive to, you know, different addictions, but I think people can get the point here. It'd be like if an alcoholic, right, is constantly going to a bar with his buddies after work.
Where he's just trying to have a social experience, right?
And just to hang out, right? But he's not going to drink, right? You know, that's going to become a problem, right? Everybody
would
acknowledge that. That's going to be difficult for him to do that. Whereas somebody that maybe alcohol has never been an issue for them, it's not been a temptation for them, they could go and hang out with people at a bar and it's not going to be a problem. It's not going to be a temptation. It's not going to detract from the rest of their life for that to happen, right? It's not going to lead them down a dark path, so to speak. So that would be what Paul would call strong believers, people who aren't really going to be led away by this. And so for them, maybe it is okay for them to eat food sacrificed to idols because it's not a religious experience for them, right? It's just meat. It's just a barbecue, right? This isn't, right. This isn't a worship service. It's just a barbecue kind of thing.
So I think with what you just said, Ben, I can back up to verse 8 now. And Paul says, we're no worse off if we do not eat and no better off if we do. It seems like he's saying it really doesn't matter. It's not about whether or not you eat the meat. Kind of like he was saying about mm-hmm. circumcision, right? It doesn't matter whether you're circumcised or not. That's not the point. It's not about circumcision in and of itself. It just depends on context. And so I see him often in his, what we might read as moral or ethical pronouncements, where he's not actually making them. He's actually saying, you have to take these things in context, right?
Yeah.
Ben, you mentioned, again, paganism, and you mentioned polytheism. Do you want to go back a little bit to this conversation about monolatry and monotheism?
Yeah, we can.
Okay. So Paul's saying, yeah, there are lots of gods, but there's only one God to us. And if we take away that LDS interpretation of the God of this world, right, then what are we left with in Paul's context?
Yeah. So these ideas, I mean, we often will just talk about there's two things, you know, polytheism and versus monotheism, but those are too broad a categories to really describe what's going on here. Because if somebody reads this in Paul, he says, oh, there's lots of different gods. It's like, wait, I thought you were a monotheist.
Right.
Right. Or are you a polytheist? Right. And well, it turns out there's more nuanced terms to describe really the way that they viewed, you know, the situation with deities, right, with the divine. And we've talked about some of these terms when we discussed the Israelite mindset within the Old Testament that helped understand some of the verses in the scriptures that, you know, strict monotheism we might term as, look, there is only one God exists, everything else is just fantasy, right? Whereas the ancient Israelite concept was more like, okay, these other gods do exist, but there's only one that we worship. And then there's a distinction between what we might call monolatry, which is that, and henotheism as well, which would be saying something like, well, there are all these gods, but there's only one who deserves to be worshipped, right? And so, whereas like monolatry might say something like, well, it's okay for other people to worship their gods, but for us, we have to worship this God type of thing, right? Now, within this context, again, that's important because the people that are going and eating the food sacrifice to idols, right? The idea isn't that these gods don't exist, right? These gods do exist, and we better not pay homage to them because we now belong to this other God, right? We've given our right. loyalties and our allegiance to this God. And so if we're doing this, then in our hearts, what might be happening in our hearts, right? Our hearts might be turned to these other gods. And so we want to avoid a situation. And for Paul, it's not about what is happening outwardly. It's not about the actual eating of the meat. It's about what that might do to our hearts, right? Or where our hearts might be in that situation.
And that really is the crux of the matter for Paul. You know, I can give you another example from when the Christians are persecuted and the Romans had this attitude that it reminds me of George W. Bush, right? Either you're with us or you're against us, right? And so there's this test that the Romans have. They say, okay, it's fine. You say you're whatever, Christian, whatever you're saying, but we just want, because the Roman gods are the gods of the state and they have to be serviced in whatever way, worshipped in whatever way, such that they would be on our side to protect us and for us to have victory in war and things like this, right? So we just want you Christians to make just a token sacrifice on the altar of the Roman gods, right? And the Christians couldn't, because it's not that they thought that the Roman gods were fantasy, that they didn't exist. It's, no, they are demons. And actually, we get in this week's reading something about demons, right?
Yeah, he does talk about it.
So it's not that they don't exist. It's that they're these, what the Romans are calling gods, are actually demons. And we can't sit at meat before the one true God and eat the food sacrificed to a demon, right? We can't do that. And we can't make this token, even a token sacrifice on the altar. We would rather die, right, than do that in front of the one true God.
Yeah. So on this idea, then these terms that Paul uses that we translate as like weak and strong, this reminded me of some terms that are used in Doctrine and Covenants section 89, which is the revelation on the word of wisdom. And it actually brings in this phrase that says, the weakest of saints, right? This is adapted to the weakest of saints. And I think I never really got what the context of that word was, like what it was getting at. And now seeing what Paul means by this and where he's going with this weak concept, again, not a judgment on the character or the strength of the faith of the person, rather talking about their background, right? Where they come from, how they arrived at where they are now, and the things they need to avoid in order to keep their covenants, so to speak, right? And so when we look at Doctrine and Covenants section 89, and it talks about it being adapted to the weakest of saints, right here we're talking about standards, which we have then termed as like a health code, right, that are meant to be taken in the context of what a person can handle themselves spiritually such that they don't have an addiction or a predisposition to something that detracts from their discipleship, right? And so that's why we get things like prescriptions of drinking or of tobacco use or things like that.
Yeah, so maybe we're talking about someone who has an addictive personality, right? So maybe it would be okay for you, Ben, to have a glass of wine once in a while. But because there's somebody else who, if they had a glass of wine, they wouldn't be able to stop at one, that we just say, you know what? No wine. It's just better, right? This is adapted to the capacity of the weakest of the weak. It's for me, not you, Ben.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Something like that.
And again, you know, weak doesn't mean the strength of your faith. It just has to do with, you know, your background, where you're coming from, your tendencies, your knowledge of yourself.
Yeah, not even the strength of my character, right? It's not right. about that.
It's not
at
about
all.
That either. Exactly. Yeah. So in chapter 9, I kind of introduced this already at the beginning, but there's not a whole lot, I think, for me to comment on in chapter 9. I know you have a couple things, Christopher, but as I'm reading through this, I'm realizing, you know, Paul is just, he's just giving a defense of his decision to work for a living, as opposed to accepting financial support from others, which is what some other apostles did. And the reasons for that are kind of within the sayings of Jesus. He says the laborer's, you know, worthy of his hire. And there seems to be this whole subtext and discussion about whether ministers should be paid or not. And Paul is just saying, hey, this is the way I decided to live my life. And I think this is what God wants me to do. And that's it. You know, like that's his defense.
I think it's important to ask this question, Ben. Do you think he's saying that everyone should do as him?
I don't think so.
Or everyone should do what he does?
Yeah. No. I don't even think he's saying that. Yeah.
That doesn't sound like Paul, does it? And he's always telling us, you know, this is how I would do it. I'm not saying you should have to do it this way.
Yeah.
In some way. And I think you have to read carefully to see this, but it's there.
Yeah.
Right? I think there are even times, I remember last time we talked, last week's reading, right? You have, would that everyone would be like me. And it sounds like he's saying, oh, we should be like him.
Yeah.
But then he says, but. Not only does he say but even a different translation helps you see that he's saying, yeah, it'd be kind of nice if everybody did their things the way I did them, but they don't.
Yeah.
And not just they don't, but God gave them agency to choose, right? So even here, you know, he's saying the same thing. I think he's saying, in verses 19, I'm thinking 19, 20, 21, right? Well, I'm just focusing on those verses, but he's giving us a series of things. In addition to his argument for supporting himself by working, he's saying that when he's preaching the gospel, he will just sort of go and do as, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, I think is a way I could paraphrase this, right? I think that's a valid paraphrase. And so I like particularly these verses that I pointed out, 19 through 21, because he says, and I'm going to quote here from NRSV, to those under the law, I become as one under the law. In parenthesis, though I myself am not under the law. See, I'm not actually under the law, meaning I don't have to perform all the Torah performances, right? That we're talking about that law, right? So that I might win those under the law. So he's trying to convert people. So when he's talking to those people, he's going to kind of do what they do. He's especially not going to do what they wouldn't do. Right? I think if we can turn this around and see that. To those outside the law, on the other hand, in verse 21, he says, I become as one outside the law. And then in parenthesis, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law. So it's like, I'm not, it's not that I'm just free from law. No, I just don't have to do the Torah stuff because now I'm a Christian, right? I have Christ's law. And I'm doing this so that I might win those outside the law. So he's going to actually, what is he going to do? I don't know. Like how naughty does he look? How naughty does he get actually? Because he says he's going to go ahead and become as one outside the law. And he's doing this so that, you know, and when in Rome, do as the Romans do, so that he can fit in and be able to talk to the people and have them take him seriously and actually listen to him and be converted. And that's interesting. So we could take this as sort of an LDS missionary, find the commonalities and focus on those. But I think Paul's going farther than that. I think, you know, Paul would be taking off the tie and, right, maybe even taking off his shirt, because here, you know, I'm in this setting where everybody doesn't have a shirt on. I don't know if you're at the beach or whatever. The missionaries don't go to the beach, right? Or if they do, they keep their shirts on, right? So that's what I'm seeing here. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, it's something like, you know, Paul trusts his ability and discernment to really understand the grace of God, right? Such that when he does something that maybe outwardly appears to contradict some sort of law, he knows that his heart is always in the right place. So it doesn't matter how it looks, because his heart is always in the right place.
Yeah. And so this reminds me of, you know, going back to last week's reading, I recorded with my Sufi master, Dr. David Peck, Sufi Al-Hajj Daoud, our first episode of a Come Follow Me podcast with Sufi exegesis, right? So here's a conversation between me and my Sufi master that we're putting out there for public consumption, an actual conversation where I'm learning as a disciple from my Sufi master. And we talked about Paul. And if we want to take Paul as an example, which I think is a fine idea, we just can't take him at any of these things that he himself is telling us aren't the thing to take as an example. But where we can take an example is he's going to do, not following, you know, the Torah in the way of, oh, you have, remember, he was a Pharisee, right? He doesn't want to turn, he's not going to act like a Pharisee, right? Where he's not going to do all the things, you know, walk this many steps, whatever, you know, without getting into details, whatever the things are. The point is, he's going to do whatever is fitting in the circumstances. And so, and he's giving you again, he's recognizing that you have to judge for yourself, right? Not do as he does necessarily, because what does he do? You can't even really say what he does, because he does, as he shows you here in these verses, whatever is fitting to the circumstance. And so that comes from, that's not from morality or ethics, right? That comes from somewhere deeper. And so that's the conversation we had on of saints and Sufis.
Yeah, sounds dangerous.
Yeah, sure, it does, right? Because why? Because you're not relying on external authority.
Yeah.
It's really about your soul and your relationship to the divine and your authority, right? Not relying on external authority, but on your own authority, because who is ultimately responsible for your soul? Not Paul, mm-hmm. Not the church, you.
Yeah.
Not even God, right? Because he gave you to choose, right? So it's you who are responsible. And so that's the conversation we had.
I'm really looking forward to listening to that podcast, Christopher, as soon as you get it published. That sounds like really good stuff.
By the time this episode is published, that should be published already. Yeah.
Sounds good. Right at the beginning of chapter 10, Paul does sort of a summary of the book of Numbers. I mean, there's some Exodus stuff obviously going on in there. And he talks about the rock in the wilderness, right? The rock that Moses hit with his staff and the water came out. So there was a tradition, and this isn't in the book of Numbers, but there's this tradition that the rock followed them in the wilderness. Like it I guess, rolled around with them everywhere. It's not really clear.
A rolling stone. It was trying to gather no moss. I remember this story.
Yeah. So the rock follows them in the wilderness. And again, this is a tradition or of the way that it happened, but it's not in the text. We don't go back to the Numbers text and see that the rock followed them. Now, this is a tradition that Paul ascribes to, because he talks about that being the case here, right? Now it is in the Christian text, right? But not in the Jewish text. So Paul calls the rock itself Christ.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I thought the rock was Peter.
Yeah. It's right? Kind of interesting. There's a lot of symbolism with rocks around there. Now, this there is a first century CE Jewish interpreter, Philo, who equates the rock with wisdom. But then he calls the manna the logos.
Oh, interesting.
And so this is just sort of juxtaposed.
That's in the Jewish tradition.
Yeah, in the Jewish tradition, exactly. Sort of juxtaposed against how the Christian tradition is calling things, because, you know, everything's about Christ. Everything's about Jesus. So the rock is Jesus. The logos is Jesus, right? Everything is Jesus. And so I just thought that was kind of interesting how
that is
every symbol from the Old Testament becomes Jesus, even to Paul. Even he's taking this Jewish tradition of the rock following them around, and that's Christ that's following them around in the wilderness, right?
That is really interesting, Ben, yeah.
Now, throughout, you know, it's not just in 1 Corinthians, but especially in 1 Corinthians, we get a lot of times where Paul will make these statements and then comment on them. And in the King James translation, we mentioned this last time, I think, it's not really obvious who is saying what, but in the NRSV, it's a little more helpful, even though they make some mistakes as well. They put quote marks around phrases, and then it's Paul responding to that quote, right? Because it's like he's replying to a letter and he's quoting part of whatever letter was written to him, and then he comments on that. So like in verse 23, we get this quote, "All things are lawful." And this is just an indication that Paul does this multiple times. He quotes a letter and then he responds to that quote. Now the verses kind of 25 through 30, Paul gets back into the concept of this, the eating the meat sacrificed to idols. And he kind of gives these different rules about stuff. But as I was reading through this, I just realized this is Paul's don't ask, don't tell policy on eating meat, right? Like,
oh, that's funny.
As long as you don't know that it was, right, then it's okay, because you're not going to think of it in those terms, right? You're not going to think of it as being meat sacrificed to idols, and it's not a religious thing. You're just eating meat. This is just eating. But as soon as you ask and find that out, then all of a sudden it could become a religious thing, right?
Yeah, and that's consonant with what he said earlier about this too, yeah. Right? It's not about whether or not you eat it. That's not what makes the difference.
So it's better if you don't even know.
Yeah, exactly. Now I'm going to back up to verse 15, Ben. This is just one of the examples of many. They're peppered throughout these letters, right? Here you have in verse 15, "I speak as to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say." You see what he's doing? He does this all the time. I have an opinion. And sometimes he says this is his opinion. But wasn't that what we saw last week? And the whole thing's canon now, right? This is, and we try to make all of it prescriptive when Paul's telling us that he's just telling us his opinion. He's giving his opinion. And here he says, "I speak as to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say." Which is not to say, by the way, and I'm reading this out of context, right? The verse before this is, "Therefore, my friends, flee from the worship of idols." And right before that, different paragraph, we get what? This famous verse about you're not going to be tempted above what you can withstand. If you're given a temptation, you're given a way out. Somehow that makes me think, this may be sort of a mirror image of that, but it makes me think of, I am human. Nothing human is alien to me. So there's a sense in which if anybody can do it, I can, right? So, and if no one could withstand the temptation, that would be kind of unfair to have this. You know what I mean? Like, what kind of temptation is there that no one can actually withstand? Then why would we even call it a sin, right? At that point, yeah, nobody can really do anything about it. So he says, "I speak as a sensible people, judge for yourselves what I say." Another way we could read that is, as I said earlier, you have to make your own judgment because you are an agent, right? You are the author of your own book of life, right? You have to judge for yourself. You're an agent. You're responsible for your own soul. So even if he is telling us what should be, we still have to make our own judgment. But what I see him saying more often than not is, I'm giving my opinion, and this isn't gospel truth. Would you agree with that, Ben?
Yeah, But, you know, he does this in the next chapter as well. He kind of starts off with some specifics and gets more general. And I think that as he's working through these specifics, he's kind of realizing that people need the more general principles. So he kind of inserts that, well, this is, I'm speaking in terms of my understanding and reasoning of this, but here's the principle. And we get this at the end of this chapter. Obviously, he's not thinking in chapters, right? But we get this at the end of this sort of this paragraph, so to speak. So here in verse 31, he says, do everything for the glory of God, right? So kind of that's kind of this overarching principle. I've talked about all these particulars, and you're going to have to judge the circumstances for yourself. You can't go off all of these rules I just gave you. I'm giving you examples of how it might apply, but here's the principle. And then you got to take that and apply that. Do everything for the glory of God.
Another way to read that, Ben, which isn't in at all in disagreement with you, I'm just adding to what you're saying, is it's the idea that it's the intention that matters. It's where your heart is, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about whether you do the thing or not. It's not about whether you eat the meat or not. It's about what are you doing, right? What's your motivation for doing this and where does it lead you? And that's something you have to judge for yourself as an agent.
Yeah. Now, right off in chapter 11, verse 2, the King James Version uses a word that I don't think is justified. It says, you know, keep the ordinances as I delivered them to him. But, you know, and ordinances may be an okay word, but in the Latter-day Saint context, I think this misleads us because the word doesn't have to do with what we would term ordinances, right? In the NRSV, we get this word traditions, which is probably better, but the Greek word is referring to a teaching or an instruction. And that would be as in like the Jewish law, like the Torah, right? So Paul has given then some teachings and instructions, and he wants them to pass those teachings and instructions down. I mention that because, you know, as Latter-day Saints, we're largely reading the King James Version, and we can read this verse and see this word ordinances and think, oh, Paul taught them exactly how to do baptism and exactly how to do this thing and this thing, and he needs them to do those ordinances and pass that down right this way. And that's actually not apparently really what he's saying here. I mean, I guess it could have been included, but that's not the specific implication. He's really just talking about his teachings.
Yeah, so here in NRSV, Ben, that verse reads, I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions just as I handed them on to you. By the way, tradition, it comes from a Latin word, which means handed to you, right? The traditions just as I handed them to you. Traditions are just things that are handed down. It's actually related to the remember we talked about Jesus being handed over and how that was translated as a betrayal?
Yeah,
it's just a handing over, right? Yeah. And right, the traditore, right? The Italian for traitor is just one who hands over. So that could be a betrayal, but it's just a handing over. And all traditions that we have are things that have been handed down to us. And that's what that means.
Yeah.
So we're not really talking about ordinances in an LDS sense. You make a good point. Now, this chapter's interesting because this is a chapter you mentioned at the beginning that deals with hairstyles.
Yeah.
And I just want to preface this chapter by pointing out something that you brought up in our pre-show discussion, which is it looks like, and I read it a little bit differently, but came to the same conclusion somehow. But I like the way you put it, Ben, because and I just want to have this up front, right? Whatever we say, whatever Paul's saying here, in the end, he seems to talk himself out of it.
Yeah.
Which so that it ends not that different from last chapter that you just told us, right? Whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do everything for the glory of God. Right. So it's not really and also backing up one more time to it's not about whether you eat meat or not, or backing up to it's not about whether you're circumcised or not. That's not it. So let's go into this.
Yeah. When I was first going over some of the commentary, they said the point at issue is difficult to determine.
Oh, this is the one.
Yeah, it was
interesting. This is the one point of Paul's that we can't figure
just,
out.
Just right? This one, right? There's right, obviously facetious there. There's a lot of stuff that it's difficult to determine what Paul is getting at sometimes. I think that the context of this can be very lost on us. It can make the imperatives that Paul gives here basically irrelevant unless we're able to renegotiate this and find meaning, some different principles going on here. Now, I know, Christopher, you have some commentary from Amy Jill Levine that really kind of helps us crack this open a little bit. But it's that is kind of funny because in the end, I agree, Paul kind of comes back and says, you know, I told you all these things, but they don't matter as much as it seems.
Yeah, so you mentioned Amy Jill Levine. She's the editor of the, well, I guess, yeah, editor. The Jewish Annotated New Testament is an NRSV translation, but with commentary from her that really helps to put this early Christian movement, which is a Jewish movement, right? Again, those people at that time, they saw Pharisees, Sadducees, Jesus followers, right? It's just one more category of Jews, right? So she's helping us see the Jewishness of this movement at this point. And some of it is just general context. Some of you may be familiar with it. I was familiar with some of it. Who's covering their head, when, and why, right? So let's talk about this a little bit. So in the first place, it's interesting to note that pagan priests and Jewish covered their heads. And then the other men who are worshiping didn't cover their heads. So Paul's saying to men, nobody should cover their head because, now this is me interpreting, because we don't want to look like any of us are pagan priests. Mm-hmm. So it's just better if nobody covers their head. But the thing about women is, in the context in which Paul is writing, it's actually shameful for a woman, for a woman's head to be shaved, right? That's actually something that's done to shame women. And it's actually the case that women who are married are wearing a veil, and it's a sign of their, you know, sort of don't talk to me, I'm married, right? There's that, and that's both Jewish their women, social Roman status. Women yeah, at the like, time. Yeah, it's about social status.
Social yeah. Structure, yeah.
And so it turns out that the hijab, this is a hijab we're talking about, Ben, right?
Yeah,
hijab
yeah,
is just a headscarf. Yeah, covering of the hair with cloth. This is the same context. Over in the Muslim tradition, there are all kinds of arguments about this. A lot of we see the hijab in the Muslim tradition. We don't see it in the Christian tradition, or at least
not as much.
Not in our.
There are some Christian traditions Christian tradition. That do
yeah,
cover.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. When I was studying Arabic in Jordan at the University of Jordan as part of my BYU study abroad program, you know, I lived with a family that was Greek Orthodox Christian. It was a retired, my host father was a retired Greek Orthodox Sunday school teacher, and I went to church with them, and the women covered their hair in worship. They didn't do it in any other context, right? Not even out and about on the town shopping or something, definitely not at home, right? And Muslim women don't wear their hijabs at home. So just like Muslim women today, the Jewish women and Roman women at that time covered their head in public, but not in private, right? Not at home. And so the question is this, in Islam at least, the question is this Islamic or is it cultural and it predates Islam? And my answer is it's cultural and it predates Islam. And it's the same in this context, right? This is just something that women did. So I don't think we think today, I know we don't think today, that women have to cover their head when they worship. Otherwise, they may as well be shaved and be ashamed of themselves, right? That's not how we think of it. But we do have these traditions that if a woman wants to wear a hat in church, it's okay. Men should remove their hats before they go in church. But once again, it depends on your tradition, right? I'm thinking just sort of Western Christians. Mm-hmm. In different traditions, you know, you cover your head to pray or you uncover your head to pray. And it just seems to be culture. And I can't help but think of Herodotus. I know how much you and I both love mm-hmm. Herodotus, right? This is something we have in common. And I love the part in Herodotus. This is the Greek historian, the first historian, right? He's going around making inquiries of how things became to be, right? How did these pyramids get built, right? Historia means inquiry, right? So he goes around talking to all these people and he comes back and he says, you know, I talk to these people who bury their dead. And then there's these other people over here, they eat their dead. And if you talk to the people who eat their dead about burying the dead, they just think, what? That's just wrong. You can't bury your dead. But if you go talk to the people who bury their dead, eat your dead. What do you know?
Yeah.
We don't eat our dead, right? And so it just becomes culture. So the question is, how is this relevant to us, Ben? And you were kind of saying, even Paul's not really sure that he's making a good argument. Let's go into arguments a little bit. If I look at verses, you know, 5 through 10, I see some sort of if then kind of, you know, because this, then that kind of argumentative structure, but there aren't any good arguments here. You know, there's sort of these
non sequiturs.
Yeah, they're non sequiturs, or they're just appeal to the culture, right? Appeal to authority, some kind of external authority, the authority of culture or whatever. They don't really seem to make much sense.
There is something interesting that happens in verse 5, an implication that, you know, it says that women shouldn't pray or prophesy without their head covered, right? Well, the implication in there is that women should pray and prophesy in church, right? Even if it stipulates they do it in a particular way. This is going to come up in later chapters where we get these likely interpolations that talk about women not speaking in church, where Paul here says explicitly that they should, right? Even if he is prescribing that they do it in a particular way. So
that's right. Yeah. So we'll have to remember to come back to this verse when we get there.
Yeah. Now, when we get to verse 11, you know, Paul kind of says something to the effect of, you know, and I'll read some of the quotes, but he says something to the effect of, you know, yeah, I said all of that, but, you know, here's really the point. And he says, nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, or man independent of woman. Judge for yourselves. There it is again, Christopher. He says, we have no such custom. Okay, so in other words, if I were to paraphrase Paul here, right? He's saying there's no eternal principle demanding all of these practices that I just told you about. We might be able to look at some appeal to nature, which would be kind of a Stoic argument, right? This is the way that things should be naturally, and so we do this naturally.
And nowadays, Ben, we call this the natural fallacy.
Yeah.
Right. We actually see it as a fallacy, a logical fallacy.
Yeah.
To make an appeal to nature.
It's natural. Right? That's just the way that it is in nature. Or then he says, he kind of makes an appeal to customary practice, right? But he does here concede the point, this isn't some what we might call eternal principle, right? This is just something that looks potentially natural or a custom. But he says, judge for yourselves, because in the Lord, even later, you know, in other letters, he says there's no male or female, right? That there's no distinction in the Lord between these things. This is cultural type of stuff.
I want to take this to what I think is its logical conclusion. And I hope my logic's better than Paul's, you know, what I'm seeing here. You know, so I think it's easy for us to accept that because we don't think that women have to cover their heads in church, right? And we don't think that men, that it makes any difference whatsoever whether our heads are covered or not when we pray, other than, again, in our culture, we shouldn't have our hats on inside the building, right? But that's not our religion telling us
that's
that.
That's
the culture, which could have come from here, ironically, right? For all I know. So, but the point I want to make is, it's easy for us to set these things aside because there's no eternal principle in them. But I think if we get into the spirit of what Paul is saying, that what we end up with is neither is there necessarily in some of the things that we hold on to today that we might think have some objective eternal significance that they may not have. And remember, in this week's reading, we get this, you know, for now we see, this is chapter 13, right? For now we see through a glass darkly. Right? And then face to face. We don't really know, back to chapter 8, verse 1, we don't really know anything. If we think we do, but we don't. We're just learning. And I think if we can take the attitude, and I think it's an attitude of humility of, I'm learning. The restoration is an ongoing process, right? Revelation is a slow, gradual process that has been going on. You know, God has been revealing himself to us since the beginning. And, you know, a couple of times, he's really appeared. And by the way, we know exactly what he looks like now because he's appeared. He has a body. Or wait, is it a bush?
Yeah.
You see what I mean? So I think we might end up putting too much stock in sort of versions of things and they become the version.
Yeah. And the other idea here is we need to be responsible for our own understanding, for our own relationship with God, right? That we don't make that relationship so dependent on the understanding of others And I think that's part of what Paul is saying here. You need to judge for yourself. You need to arrive in a place of your relationship with God that you can start discerning these things for yourself.
And I think that's really clear too. So I'm reminded in this conversation of a quote from Ibn Arabi. Ibn Arabi was an Arab Andalusian Muslim scholar, mystic, poet, philosopher. He's a lot like Rumi, only he comes first, right? So Rumi is more familiar. Ibn Arabi comes before Rumi. He's known as Al-Sheikh Al-Akhbar, right? The greatest Sheikh, which is something like elder or learned one, depending on your tradition, right? Someone who has a lot of learning. And this is what he said. And he's a mystic, of course, in saying this. And I'm actually reading from, this is from Karen Armstrong's A History of God. Ibn al-Arabi gave this advice. So this is a paraphrase. Do not attach yourself to any particular creed exclusively so that you may disbelieve all the rest. Otherwise, you will lose much good. Nay, you will fail to recognize the real truth of the matter. God, the omnipresent and omnipotent, is not limited by any one creed, for he says, wheresoever ye turn, there is the face of Allah. Quran 2:109. Everyone praises what he believes. His God is his own creature, and in praising it, he praises himself. Consequently, he blames the disbelief of others, which he would not do if he were just, but his dislike is based on ignorance. And there's an echo from this quote in Voltaire, whether I'm not saying Voltaire read Ibn Arabi, but God created man in his image, and man has been trying to return the favor ever since. And so I think what Ibn Arabi is saying is, if we get too enamored with our conception of God, then it might even blind us to actually seeing God. Remember that Jesus was walking side by side, the resurrected Jesus was walking side by side with his disciples who were sad and talking to each other about how sad they were about Jesus being dead while he was walking next to them, right?
Yeah.
And not recognizing him. He was right there next to them. And he talks to them and they still don't know who he is. What's going on? What, you haven't heard? What rock have you been living under? Or behind, right? And so going from Ibn Arabi to Rumi, I can't fail to quote at this point Rumi, who says, there are as many paths to God as there are people on earth. Once again, I am responsible for my soul. You are responsible for your soul. Not the church, not Paul, not God. You. So given what I just said, some of you listening may agree, some may disagree. Well, let's go into that, because here in verse 18 and 19, we see that in this letter. Paul says, for to begin with, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you, and to some extent I believe it. Indeed, there have to be factions among you, for only so will it become clear who among you are genuine. When you come together, it is not really to eat the Lord's Supper. For when the time comes to eat, each of you goes ahead with your own supper, and one goes hungry and another becomes drunk. What? I'm in verse 22 now. What, do you not have homes to eat and drink in? Or do you show contempt for the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? What should I say to you? Should I commend you in this matter? I do not commend you. It's kind of hard to tell what's going on in verses 21 or 20 through 22 if you didn't understand 18 and 19 correctly. So let's go into verses 18 and 19, right? When you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you, and to some extent I believe it. So it's really 19 we're talking about here. Indeed, there have to be factions among you. What does the King James Version read?
So King James says, for there must be also heresies among you, that they which are approved may be made manifest among you.
Okay, hold on. So there must be heresies among you. Here we have in NRSV, there have to be factions, right? What is that? Yeah, there have to be factions among you. So there are two things I want to focus on. It's the have to be or must be, depending on your translation, or the factions or heresies. First, the have to or must be. Ben, you and I went behind the English translations to the Greek, and what did we find? Yes, have to, must be, these are possible translations, but included in the lexical range of this word that we're translating is...
So it really makes a lot more sense in context to do something like, it is inevitable that there will be, right? Like inevitable. Paul is describing something, not prescribing something.
Yeah, so it's inevitable that something's going to happen. Now we have to go into the something. On the one hand, heresies. On the other hand, factions. Must there be factions? I don't know that we want to put out a podcast to a, well, it's still a Latter-day Saint audience, but although this is rapidly changing, perhaps it's mostly an American audience, right? We have an audience that's worldwide, but mostly American. To say that factions are necessary, I don't think they're necessary, and I think they're a problem right now in America, mm-hmm. right? So let's not do this. Let's look at what's going on here. But if we go to the King James and we get heresy, well, that doesn't sound much better. But the Greek word behind this translation, heresy, is haeresis. And haeresis literally means to make your own choice. And so the reason that that becomes what we call heresy today, right, is that for those who were the medieval theologians, who were especially those who were coming into contact with other faiths like the Muslims, right? There couldn't be disagreement. And that's actually, there's a basis for not having disagreement, for becoming one, except we have to understand it correctly. And I think that's where we're going with this here in this letter, right? But everybody has to believe the same thing. And if you believe otherwise, that's you choosing, right? You're making a choice. You're choosing another belief. And so that's what's meant here. So how would you then, given what I've said, Ben, how would you translate this? What could we say?
Yeah, I might say something like, indeed, it's inevitable that there would be differences of opinion among you. Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. That's a good interpretation. So then what? Now we come to verses 20 and 21, and they make a lot more sense. Because what he's saying is, instead of you coming together, and the members of the body of Christ are remembered, right? As we say mm-hmm. in the sacrament prayer, in the Eucharist, right? Instead of becoming one, and this is actually spelled out in these chapters, right? That the idea that all of the members form the body, and that no one member is more important than the other. They're all parts of the body. And so we have to become one body of Christ. The Christian community is one body, which, by the way, should have us thinking about other sects, right? I mean, if you're a Latter-day Saint, then you should be thinking here of your evangelical brothers and your Lutheran brothers and your Catholic brothers and sisters and your Greek Orthodox brothers and sisters and your Eastern and Russian and, right, all of these Orthodox yeah. traditions, all of them, right? We're supposed to be one body. And instead, what verses 21 through 22 are saying is you're doing the opposite. There's division. You're creating all this division and you're making a mockery of this whole thing.
Yeah, you know, Paul seems to be pointing out that, look, I know in reality that people aren't perfectly united. You have different opinions. You view things differently. You know, you're different
people. That's inevitable.
That's inevitable. But the community of Christ, you are supposed to be modeling unity. And so when you come together, you are ritualistically modeling that unity. You're supposed to be doing that. And you're not doing that, right? You're doing all these things that show terrible division among the people. But what we are trying to do is model this unified community. And so then he goes into the story of why it was instituted in the first place, right? He goes back to Jesus, you know, that Jesus started this whole thing. And he said, do this in remembrance of me. I'm unified, right? Remembrance, that kind of thing.
I'm unified, yeah. So this is an important question though, Ben. Does this mean that, because if it does, then I have to withdraw what I shared from Ibn Arabi and from Rumi, and that would all be heresy, right? So does this mean that we should all have the same opinion? Or would that actually contradict what we've been reading in Paul?
Well, I don't know that the word is should. I think what Paul is saying is that we don't know exactly how the unity is going to come about. That's maybe a mystery that God is working through us. What we do know is that Christ gave us this way to model a unity, right? A symbolic ordinance that brings us together. And as we do this and we practice this, the Spirit will guide us into how we become more unified. But I don't think Paul is making some like imperative or prescription about exactly how the unity is supposed to happen, simply that they are to model it in this symbolic, ritualistic way. And as they do that with sincerity, the Spirit will teach them then how to do it externally, right?
I like that answer. And that's, I think I could actually interpret it as if I try to take what you said and make it a more direct answer to the question as I posed it, then no, he doesn't expect us to all have the same opinion, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't even, and this is actually, I'll add to that. I thought this is where you were going, Ben. I'm thinking back to 8:1 and to the end of chapter 13, our bookends again for this conversation. And I thought you were saying, we just don't know. When you said we don't know how it's going to come about, we don't know. And I thought, yeah, we don't know. How could we expect everybody to have the one and only, you know, a true and living opinion on the face of the earth if we don't know what that is?
Yeah.
Right? Paul says we don't know, and we still don't know. I think that's still true. We're still finding out. And that's why I think Ibn Arabi has a good point. We have to be open to God, the God who's walking next to us.
Right? Yeah.
Who wants to know what we're so sad about because we miss him while he's walking next to us. Yeah.
Yeah. And to the point that you were making with chapter 13 then, that the way that we arrive at that understanding, or we can only arrive at that through love, right? And that's modeled through this manifestation of the grace of God that's done within this symbolic eating and drinking of the body and blood of Christ, right? So when in verse 27, there is this discussion about not eating and drinking unworthily of what we would call the sacrament, right?
Okay. Yeah, let's go into that.
Yeah. So unworthily, you know, this term often in our tradition is used to refer to a state of a person who has committed some act in the past. And so because of that act in the past, they are now in a state of unworthiness, right?
Which means what? Because you still are using the term unworthy, right?
Yeah. Which means they're not fit. Yeah. They're not fit
to participate in the ordinance.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Especially here when we're talking about the sacrament, the ordinance of the sacrament, the Eucharist.
Yeah.
So what do we do that? By the way, Ben, you and I have been guilty of saying you're already always worthy. Yeah. So is Paul contradicting us? Are we preaching false doctrine? What's going on here?
Well, you could say that in a sense. I think within the context here, and again, there's semantics that gets pulled into this, right? But what I want to do for Paul, at least, is take this in the context of his understanding that he comes to in Romans, right? So Paul's understanding of worthiness in Romans is something like a recognition of the grace of God. So remember, the rejection or the ignorance of the grace of God is sin. And so if you're coming out of that and you are accepting and perceiving and seeing the grace of God all around you, that is basically the definition of worthiness. It's simply that reflexive understanding of your own worth, right?
And that's being faithful, right, Ben?
Yeah.
That's being faithful. So that, I don't think I said this when we had that conversation, but I'm going to add this. We're familiar with the term infidel, right? This is the opposite of being faithful. This is to be lacking in faith, right? An infidel. We usually think of infidels in terms of, well, like in the Islamic tradition, right? You get the idea that an infidel is therefore someone who is non-Muslim or anti-Muslim or something like that, right?
Or that's apostate or something.
Or apostate. Yeah, exactly. Apostate could have left Islam, right? But this word infidel is translating an Arabic word, kafir, which literally means ungrateful. Mm-hmm. This is a failure to recognize the grace of God.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah. And that's exactly what Paul is saying when we get to verse 28. He says, we should not partake without examining ourselves. He says to examine yourself. And he says to discern the body. Well, okay. So what does he mean there? Well, the body he's referring to here is the body of Christ. Symbolically, the community, but even thinking of Christ himself, right? And the community both being manifestations, physical manifestations, or at least, you know, present before our eyes manifestations of the grace of God. And so the idea that we are recognizing that, seeing that, right, then immediately we're brought into a condition of gratitude because we are acknowledging that presence. And that is then the state that makes us, for lack of a better term, or defines us as worthy.
Okay, so if I'm following along with you, Ben, now I have the question of why does it say next that if you're unworthy when you partake, you'll be damned?
Yeah.
Right? Doesn't that mean I'm going to hell?
No, this is really useful terms here. So we do use the word damned to imply an eternal condemnation, right? But it really has a different idea. Yeah, it's really something different. Yeah. So I'm going to, to contextualize my thoughts on this, I'm first going to go back to bring in some similar verses that we find in the Book of Mormon when Christ comes to the Nephites. He tells them not to allow people to partake of what we call the sacrament unworthily, right? But I think that we read this wrong if we think this is a charge to prevent people from taking the sacrament.
What?
What we're to do is to persuade people to partake of the sacrament in the manner and spirit for which it is given. So if they don't partake of the sacrament in the manner and the spirit for which it is given, or discerning the body and examining themselves, as Paul says, right? Recognizing the grace of God, then
they go to hell.
They eat, drink damnation. Why? Because it does nothing for them, right? It provides no spiritual assistance at all. Damnation isn't a condemnation.
So what you're saying is when the text says damned, it actually means damned, meaning like when we stop a river.
Yeah.
It stops us from progressing. It stops the sacrament from having the intended effect.
Right. Yeah, they're damned in the sense that their spiritual progression is not furthered by this. And
it's impeded.
Yeah. Yes. Not only is maybe in a best case scenario, it's not furthered, right? It could just be meaningless, but it could be impeded or it could be hampered by this because instead it turns something that should be invoking God's love into something meaningless. And one of the problems we could come across with that is that now all of a sudden, this thing that could be on a regular basis bringing you closer to God doesn't have that meaning for you. And, you know, maybe you find some other mode or something like that. But this is the shared community mode. And if you don't have that meaning, right, that avenue. And it's not that there aren't other avenues, but this one is a particularly meaningful one within a community. That avenue isn't accessible to you, right? So you're damned in that sense, right? So again, this isn't an eternal condemnation. It's just, you know, those who think they are unworthy should be sought out and persuaded to participate in a manifestation of the grace of God, okay? In other words, if, let's say, I'm a bishop and I know of somebody who thinks, or maybe I notice somebody isn't taking the sacrament, right? Whereas we might conventionally be led to think, maybe, you know, we need to bring him and have him a talk in the office. Well, yeah, sure. But what are you going to talk about? You're not going to grill them necessarily. What you're going to do is try to persuade them to take the sacrament. Because if someone thinks they're not worthy, how is it that you get there? How is it that you get worthy, right? Well, you can only be worthy of
morality,
something by
Ben.
Seeing
it's
that.
Ethics, yeah. Morality, you have to do all the things, but we've already talked about this, right? That's not it.
Yeah. No, the worthiness is recognizing the grace of God. So your efforts are to persuade and help that person recognize it, and then act it out so that they can more fully experience that. So that they will recognize it. But it's the not recognizing it itself that is that definition of unworthiness or sin, according to Paul.
You know, that reminds me of, it's a line my Sufi master loves and mentioned to me. I think it's from Yes, the part you give, or the gift you give is your freedom, something like that. It reminds me of, you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free, right? Hmm.
There you go.
It's understanding the truth of it, right? Well, Ben, let's talk about chapter 12. We can't wait to get to chapter 13. I love chapter 13. But in chapter 12, Paul is listing for us, and the words of Amy Jill Levine in my Jewish Annotated New Testament, 9 activities manifesting the Spirit's work. We call these gifts of the Spirit, right? So if we see these things happening, she's saying, this is a manifestation of the Spirit at work. So, okay, yeah, somebody has the Spirit working through them, and that's why these things are showing up. So number 1 is an utterance of wisdom. Now, remember, this is the Greek Sophia, and is even personified in that tradition, right? So this is about wisdom. Number 2 is an utterance of knowledge. This is translating the Greek gnosis. Remember that we said Paul is a mystic. And so here we're talking about the kinds of teachings that Paul himself is conveying in his letters, right? That's gnosis, knowledge. Number 3, faith, which in the Jewish tradition means something like, well, I'll give you Levine's words, Amy Jill Levine's words, trustworthy words as opposed to deceitful utterances, which she says is a cornerstone of Jewish ethics, and she cites Proverbs 12:17. Then we have healing. In the Jewish tradition, the patriarchs, Moses, Solomon, and other prophets and rabbis have this power to heal from God. Number 5, miracles. The patriarchs, Solomon, prophets, rabbis, and then prophecy, which she calls speech with eschatological, ethical, or mystical insight. That's an interesting definition of prophecy, right? Eschatological, ethical, or mystical insight. Prophetology is not something we talk a lot about in our tradition. We talk a lot about what prophets are, and we talk about what they're saying, and we say that prophets can speak as prophets or as individuals. And the funnest thing for me about that, Ben, is we get to decide when they're prophets and when they're individuals, yeah. Right? So that's, which by the way, is as it should be. Yeah. I'm only half kidding, yeah. Right? We've been saying this whole time, this is what Paul's saying. We should be judging for ourselves, as Paul puts it.
Yeah.
But we don't usually define what prophecy is, other than we do say it has to have something to do with Christ, right?
Yeah.
And I think we say that scriptures have to prophesy of Christ. And so that's why we may be calling our podcast on the Quran, when we get to it, the Book of Allah, which is one of the nicknames for the Quran, one of the ways it's called, the Book of Allah, : another testament of Jesus Christ, because it actually does testify of Christ, right? And so that's fun too. Then we have number 7, the discernment of spirits, which I was reading, Ben, in pre-show discussion, it came out that I'm thinking of Joseph Smith shaking hands with to find out if it's a good spirit or bad spirit. But here it's deciding whether a spirit manifested, as Amy Jill Levine has it, in gifts is demonic or angelic. So right. You were saying, Ben, it's not about some spirit appearing to me. It's about what kind of spirit is in someone I'm talking to, or someone, yes, who's an actual person I'm dealing with. Right,
right.
Number 8. Tongues, which means speaking in foreign languages, including the language of angels, which is, as we see here in Paul, in this letter, is completely unintelligible to anybody but God, right? And then 9, interpretation of tongues. So just like we have tongues, now we have interpretation of tongues, which means we're going to be able to understand what these people are saying. I don't know if that includes the angels, yes, the tongue of angels or it, not, you know?
Yeah.
It does?
It ostensibly, okay, does, yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens with this whole idea of prophesying and speaking in tongues in church and what that's going to do as we get into this chapter.
Yeah, this chapter 12, Paul, I think I said at the beginning that Paul makes a great case for perennialism here. Now, what do I mean by perennialism? So you might be able to tweak my definition a bit here, but perennialism, as I understand it, would be the idea that all these different philosophical or religious or mystical traditions sort of stem from the same ideas or source or truths. And this is very much in line with LDS thought, right? That God is the source of all truth, and he reveals truth to his children at all times and all ages and all places of the earth, all that he sees fit that they should have, says Alma chapter 29, right? And so Paul here, it seems to be, in my estimation, making a solid case for perennialism by saying that the gifts of the Spirit are manifesting themselves differently in different people and different contexts and different cultures, but they're all from the same God, the same Christ, even if they seem very different and they're diverse, right?
Yeah, I see here in verse 12, by the way, Ben, for just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ.
Right.
Right? This is the thing I was referring to earlier. All of the members come together and form one body of Christians.
Right. And I think maybe there is the temptation here to say, oh, well, Paul is just talking about just the community, just the followers of Christ, right? Just the members of the church, right? But I don't think that that is just what Paul is talking about. I think what Paul is saying, and we get it in these later verses here, Paul is saying that the church is a representation or a model of how that should work, but that God isn't limited in his manifestations just to the people in the church, right? This is something much bigger, much broader that God is doing.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me of a verse from the Quran. And actually earlier, I forgot to mention one. We were talking about, we don't really know, we think we know, and we have all these differences, the ones that are, what did we call them? Inevitable, right? There's a verse in the Quran that says that in the end, God will tell us, he'll inform us, it says, of those things about which we differed.
Mm. Yeah.
Don't worry about that.
Yeah.
God will inform you about that, about which we differed, right? And this verse says that God could have made us all one people, you know, everybody the same, but he didn't, so that we would get to know one another. So I think it's once again by coming together as one that we gain all of the truth. Hmm. And I think this is clearly manifest. I'm just going to take this opportunity to say this, Ben. I think it's clearly manifest in how completely distinct Eastern and Western traditions are when it comes to religion and philosophy, right? These perennial topics. I think that if we have the Western, we're missing the Eastern. And if you have the Eastern, you're missing the Western, right? We need them both.
There's truly much to be learned from those traditions that we have barely scratched the surface of, really. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Riley and I will continue to do that on Latter-day Contemplation.
And I'm convinced that that is, at least in part, what the Book of Mormon means when it talks about the scriptures that we have not received yet, right?
Well, we have in our tradition, right, the idea that there are other books that we know that they exist, but we don't know them, right? They're not, it's like,
they're sealed.
It's like,
right?
We think they're not, they're sealed books, right? They're not available to us. They're sealed. We can't read them or something like that. Well, what if they're actually published books and they're in English translation? You just aren't opening them.
Yeah, they're sealed.
Right? There's no difference. Yeah, exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. Even Houdini couldn't, pick a lock that was only locked in his mind. There's at least an apocryphal story. I don't know if it's a true story, but I've heard the story about Houdini once being told that he was locked in, and he wasn't actually locked in, and he couldn't get out of it. Right? Because if that lock is locked in Houdini's mind, there's no one who can get out of it, right? Mm. Because he's the one who unlocks all the locks that are only unlocked in everybody else's mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. For him, he can get out of them.
So I like it towards the end of chapter 12, how this verse puts it, you know, verse 26, if one member suffers, all suffer together with it. If one member is honored, all rejoice together with it.
And that's the opposite of, you know, from last week's episode, envy that we were talking about. Envy, yeah. And strife, remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the opposite of that. Envy, you know, means, and this is something else we went into on Of Saints and Sufis, envy isn't jealousy. These aren't, you can't swap out one term for the other, right? Envy goes beyond jealousy. Envy is, there's a German word that we actually have borrowed into English.
Schadenfreude.
Yeah, it's the idea that you actually want, it's not just that you want what they have, you want them not to have it, right?
You get pleasure, you get satisfaction out of the pain or loss of another person. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so that's the opposite of what we're dealing with here at the end of chapter 12.
Right.
And that brings us right into the subject of chapter 13, which is love.
Right.
Love. Not, by the way, I'm going to say not charity. What do I mean by that? Ben, you and I both thought, looking at the King James Version and seeing that this chapter is about charity. By the way, when I was a boy, it was about love, right? Because I was a Lutheran. And charity, we know as Latter-day Saints, is a special kind of love. It is, by the way, it's funny because we've all heard from C.S. Lewis about the Greek words for love, and there isn't one that's the pure love of Christ, at least not in C.S. Lewis' explanation. But charity is the pure love of Christ. Well, it turns out, you know, is because I'm curious to know, well, which is it? Is it love or is it charity? It turns out it's agape. And now the interesting thing about agape is it can be this, what I would call a spiritual love, which would be something like this pure love of Christ that we don't think only belongs to Christ because we're supposed to have it ourselves. So we could have that kind of love for others. And it can be that. But it's also the word for romantic love. So it's not just this sort of special kind of Christ-like love. Even romantic love is covered by that same word. Which, by the way, brings me back to this theme that we see running through the Bible, which is the hierogamy, right? The sacred marriage between heaven and earth, that God wants to marry us. Jesus is the bridegroom, and the church is the bride.
You know, there's a sense in which when you have a large vocabulary for things, you have to make a choice about which word you use to explain a concept, right? And so when you're translating, you have to make a choice of a word. But when you have a word that is much larger, you know, a larger net or a larger sphere of meaning, big lexical range, right? And you use that word, you can really bring in a lot more concepts. And love is this English word that does this, right? It's a very huge word.
I think we want a word like that.
And here, I agree. I think how we have come to this word in English is really great, whereas we have all these other concepts. And so, you know, we have this Greek word agape. We get translated as love in some translations, charity, right? But there is a connotation of this word agape that isn't just, you know, again, a feeling. This isn't just an emotion, right? This also is used to term a gathering of the people having what they called a love feast, right? This is an agape fellowship feast, right? Which really draws our minds to the sacrament or the Lord's Supper, right? Because that's what's going on here.
Before that, because that's the Last Supper.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Before that, we have Jesus just going around having love feasts, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This table fellowship, right? Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, I saw somebody, now I'm, after 7 years off Facebook, I am lurking on Facebook. I'm not getting sucked in, but I'm lurking. And there are some groups. There's Mormon Mimetic Musings. I think that's almost a tongue twister. Mormon Mimetic Musings started by Riley Risto, right after he and I podcasted on Rene Girard's ideas and interviewed Max Sterling on Rene Girard. And those episodes are forthcoming. But I saw someone posting that they went to church and it wasn't for, you know, it wasn't for the sacrament. It wasn't for this, that, or the other. It was just because there's some cool people there. And, you know, Riley came in and replied to that. And he said, you know, I think we may be looking past the mark on this one. I'm paraphrasing, right? But isn't that what the Jesus movement was about?
That's a perfectly legitimate reason to go to church.
It is. Yeah. It may even be the best reason. It may be the only reason. I don't know. I mean, because, let's not discount the sacrament, but we've already talked about what the sacrament's doing.
Well, but it's pointing to something else, right?
Yes,
that's the whole idea. These are all pointing to something, and what is that?
It's they're pointing love. To fellowship, this love, this communal love that's shared with God, shared with Christ. That God is faithful to us, we're told. It's not just that we be faithful to God, but God is faithful to us. In that love.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, all these terms that we have used that are sort of encompassed within this very broad word in English that we have love, you know, we've talked about the word in Greek charis, which got translated as grace in Romans, right? And then we tied that to chesed, which was that Hebrew word that indicated loving kindness or covenant, or, you know, it has a very broad lexical range in terms of English, right? That it can mean a lot of things, but there's gratitude tied up in that.
Well, and that includes the love between spouses, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, which it goes back again to the hierogamy, the sacred marriage.
So it's about that relationship. We even use the word covenant. Sometimes chesed is translated as covenant because it's sure. the relationship, the loving relationship between those two people. And then within this context, between us or in general, the whole church, the body of the church and God.
Absolutely. So why not have all of that in mind when we're dealing with agape here, which can be spiritual or romantic love?
Yeah.
I think, Ben, you've shown us how all of these concepts that we've talked about fit into this chapter and what and its message. It really is central. I mean, if I'm looking for something outside of the Gospels, because if I'm in the Gospels, then the Sermon on the Mount, right? Mm. That's it. If I'm outside the Gospels, I think I'm here in chapter in 1 Corinthians chapter 13.
It's beautiful. You know, and we've been touching on this, we've been talking about this, but the central point here that Paul seems to be making is there's all of these manifestations of the Spirit, right? All these different gifts that we could see and we can say, oh, that's God acting. But we really only can call them God acting when they are infused with love, right? That is the power behind all of these things. And without that love, without that agape is the word that he uses, none of these other things really mean anything, right? They don't have the power.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, if the mic weren't so expensive, I think Ben would have dropped it right there. And that's it, right? This is it. Love. All you need is love. You know, a couple of times in recent weeks, our Come Follow Me study group has ended up with us spontaneously singing that song. Yeah. Is there anything more to say after that, Ben?
Just at the end of this chapter, we get this neat little metaphor that Paul uses talking about how we perceive reality. And this really ties it all together, right, with a nice little bow when we go back to chapter 8 and talk about knowing and really what it means to know something. You know, in the Latter-day Saint tradition, we use the word I know or the phrase I know when we're giving a testimony, which that's fine, but it's important that people contextualize that, right? You know, especially considering how Paul talks about it here. And what we are perceiving, what we may say we know is really, what does he say, through a mirror dimly or through a glass darkly is the King James, right?
Right. But we're talking about a looking glass.
Yeah. Now, you know, when I read the word mirror or even in the King James, it says glass, right? Like my understanding here is if we go back to ancient mirrors, right? They didn't use glass. They used silver, right? And they polished the surface of the silver or maybe some other kind of metal, but the really good mirrors were silver, right? Polished silver. And if anybody's ever looked in polished metal, right, you do get a reflection, but it's not that bright, crisp, verisimilitude reflection that you get when you look in the bathroom mirror, right?
Kodachrome, Ben.
Yeah.
I think what you're trying to say is Kodachrome.
Yeah.
I hope you don't get sued for this.
I haven't used that word, so I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, I'm dating myself, am I?
So I think that it's important for us to realize what Paul is thinking about when he uses the word mirror. And it's, again, it's not the glass mirror that we use where we might look in it and we're like, you know, even if there's some deception going on, which we talked about a little bit, Christopher, that's actually a very good representation or mirror representation of my person, right? Even we can zoom up closely and see that. But in a silver mirror, the image is actually very darkened. Like he says, we see through it dimly. And so it's not a very good imitation of reality. It's a poor reflection of reality, even though it's useful in some sense, right? And so that's what Paul is saying here, is that all of these concepts that we're talking about, they can be a useful reflection of reality, but they are a poor imitation in a sense. We can talk about all these terms, but really we don't have a full understanding. But the hope, the assertion is that one day we will have that greater understanding of that transcendent reality, right? That isn't just what we see in a mirror, but what we actually can see with our eyes.
So we think we know now. You know, so the Sufi tradition, you get this image in the Sufi tradition of polishing the mirror of the heart, the same mirror you were talking about polishing, Ben, polishing the mirror of the heart so that it accurately reflects the image of God, right? The Imago Dei. So you can see that image right here. This is the work of purifying the soul, right? This is the alchemist work too, right? This is the same idea. And you know, it's funny, you mentioned our mirrors as being so much better, and cameras work the same way. So photographs, and I have a photograph in front of me. We talked about this pre-show. I wanted to share this with our audience. I have a memento here from a visit with two friends, one new, one old, in Ireland this summer. And we took this picture together. And I remember looking at it for the first time, and I thought, no, that's, we weren't in that order. He wasn't on my right. He was on my left, right? So I knew something was wrong. But then I said, well, wait a minute. It's and I talked myself out of it, because we all know how the mirror works.
But it's
photo
evidence, Christopher. You can't argue with
it. I know, right? Yeah. But we all know how mirrors work. We know that things are getting reversed, and yet we still deceive ourselves. That's the problem, right? We still think, no, that really is me. It's, of course it's turned around, because it's like I'm standing over there, right? But what shocked me, and my wife was even more shocked, you should have seen her, Ben, when I told her this, is if you look at this picture, you can see my watch on my right arm. Ben, I have not worn my watch on my right arm since I was 12. Well, wait a minute. When I was 16, I had the swatches on both arms, right? But just to wear a watch on one arm on the right, I don't think I've done that since I was 12. I didn't do that on this day. And that's how it shows up in the picture. So
gives it away.
Again,
yeah.
We think we see clearly when we really see through a glass darkly, even if it isn't, even if it's, you know, one of these fancy iPhone cameras or whatever clean mirror you have in your bathroom today.
Yeah.
So as Ibn Arabi said, once again, don't fall in love. This is my paraphrase. Don't fall in love with your idea of how it is. Be open to learning. I'm always learning. I'm always finding God.
Well, that's Narcissus staring at himself in the pond, right? And falling in love with himself in the mirror.
I mean, yeah, if we read that as Sufis, of course, the beloved. Right? That's God. That's the image of God within you. Yeah, I don't think that's the point in the Narcissus and Echo story. But that is a Sufi reading. Well, Ben, I'm so glad you remembered to bring that up. All you need is love. And I was going to say a better mirror, but it's not a better mirror, right? You've got to get past that.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. I look forward to the last three chapters of 1 Corinthians next week. Thank you, Ben, as always, for doing this with me. I couldn't do it without you. And thanks to all of our Latter-day Peace Studies team, an all-volunteer team. Thanks to Riley of Latter-day Contemplation, my other podcast co-host, and to my new podcast co-host, my Sufi master, Sufi Al-Hajj Dawood, Dr. David Peck. I invite our listeners to check out that podcast of Saints and Sufis Presents, Come Follow Me. It may actually be called Of Saints and Sufis, but the series that we're following, the Come Follow Me reading, is called Presents Come Follow Me. And I invite you to share your comments with us. And I thank you for all of your comments. We receive so many encouraging comments. We know that the message we're putting out there is speaking to you, and because you've told us so. And we're glad. Our hearts are full of gratitude for you for listening and for the experience it has been to share these ideas with you and to have that feedback from you. Thank you again for listening and for your comments. Thank you to all those who donate. And please, if you like what we're doing and you want to support us, consider donating. If you would like to volunteer, let us know. Reach out to us. We have a Come Follow Me study group online on Sunday afternoons. That's at 2 to 3 Pacific. And of course, our Facebook group, other social media. I don't know a lot about social media. I am lurking on Facebook now, so maybe I'll see your post. Thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you, everybody. Have a good week.